The Red Eye Radio Podcast is a service of Freightliner and Detroit.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. I'm Gary McNamara, that is. Eric Harley has the morning off. It is you and me. We've been reminiscing here on the show, reminiscing the last 2 years, just a couple of weeks from the two-year anniversary of James Comey's testimony when he let Congress know that, or he, you know, let the world know, not Congress, but he let the world know that he was not going to file charges against Hillary Clinton. That was July 5th of 2016. I remember where I was. Because we were on vacation. I was on like the third or fourth hole of Arrowhead Golf Course in Newstead, New York. And I'd hit some pretty good shots, too. In fact, I do remember it was a short par four and I was on the fairway. I can always work golf into any conversation, can't I? But it's the truth. And I'm, you know, getting ready. I remember I was only about it's only about 90 yards. It was a short par four, so I'm like 90 yards out. My phone rings. It's Eric. and we knew that, you know, that he was going to announce something, James Comey, but and so I knew it was coming out at that point, and it was Eric saying he's not going to go, he's not going to prosecute. Like, what? And so I remember telling Eric, hang on, I got to hit this shot. And I hit the shot and I hit the green. And I said, we got to talk about this quick because I got a birdie putt coming up here. I didn't make the birdie putt, just so you know. But I did par the hole. And then I actually called him back. And then before we teed off with the next hole, I talked to him more about it. But I'll always remember where I was when that happened. And then everything that has happened since. And I remember over the last 2 years, maybe some of the callers were, you might be listening now, who said, we're never going to find out anything. We found out an awful lot in those 2 years. We found out a heck of a lot about the Hillary investigation. We found out that, you know, she had the server in. We found out what the possible charges were against her at that particular point, and we found out the excuses from the FBI and James Comey as to why he wouldn't do it. Now, most of us didn't fall for it, but the fact is we learned a lot. Well, coming up later on today, the Inspector General will give his 500-page report on any improprieties of that investigation. I just caution that not knowing what's in the investigation, that there were certain limitations in the Inspector General's investigation. For example, he didn't have access to anybody who wasn't currently employed in government, in the Department of Justice. He can only call those witnesses. He can't call somebody who says, I quit, and have them testify. Or have them, you know, be witnesses in any form. This is the Internal Inspector General. Now, he has access to a ton of different information. And as we have said before, and I brought this up today, so, I mean, Eric's not here, but I'm sure on this he would agree, because we had talked about this in the past, that I know one of the biggest things that we wonder is when James Comey came out on his book tour, what we found out in his book was that he had said the reason that he took over the investigation is because of the unverified classified information that existed about Loretta Lynch that showed her unbelievable conflict of interest in this case, which is why he had to take it over, because the opposition would have destroyed the Justice Department had that information gotten out and the opposition had access to it. Our point was always, okay, you've been out of there for a while, and so maybe it's not unverified anymore. Since you brought it up in April, that also gave time for the Inspector General to look into that. Because two questions, as we mentioned earlier in the show, and it's important to repeat, two questions that we had to ask. Number one, it was unverified when you were FBI director. You've been out. Is it still unverified? And if it was unverified and still is unverified today, why were you scared of it? Because I'm sure there's all tons of unverified information that comes from unreliable sources. And if that stopped you, and if you thought at that point that you had to take the responsibility as to whether to prosecute away from, now she had recused herself, but away from the Justice Department completely, including Sally Yates, and it was unverified, why did you do that? So some of the questions that we have, but that's really the big question. What was that information that would have tainted the Justice Department where the head of the FBI said or thought nobody in the Justice Department can be trusted to release what I'm going to say today because they have too much of a conflict of interest based on these unverified classified information that came from a secret source? To this day, we don't know what the source was or what the unverified information was. Why? It's not true. If it's unverified. We know what all the unverified information was about Donald Trump, correct? We know the P stories. We know everything, right? All unverified. So, one wonders what that information is and whether the Inspector General, after that report came out, decided, okay, I'm going to look into that also, find out what that was. Did that show him? Was that unverified information? Did it become verified? And if it was unverified, then why did Comey take the liberty of stating, I'm going to make the decision even though it's unverified, because I believe that the unverified information came out, that it would destroy the credibility of the Justice Department. Yeah, but it's unverified. If it's not true, it's not true. Anybody can throw out an accusation. So many different questions. Your calls and comments coming up. A couple of other stories we want to make sure we get to. This was from the Washington Times. We always ask this question, when was this going to start taking effect? We knew it would because of economics, and it's how people respond to incentive and disincentive. And we always ask the question with the cost of college these days and the fact that a lot of these higher education degrees that you get can't get you a job or diddly squat. When would people start saying, nope, not going to do that. Time to take the job instead. Given the choice between a six-figure college degree and a job, people are increasingly taking the job. A recent report by the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center shows a college enrollment has declined for the sixth consecutive year as the economy has rebounded from the recession. Doug Shapiro, executive research director of the center, said high-priced degrees have become less attractive as hiring has picked up. Institutions are doing a better job of holding on to their traditional age students, but continue to lose ground on enrolling older adults, Mr. Shapiro said in his statement. The part-time associates and certificate programs that were so attractive to adult students, particularly unemployed a decade ago, are showing all the effects of the recovering economy drawing those students back into the workforce. The number of post-secondary students fell to 17.8 million. This spring, the report found, down 1.3% from last year's spring term. Enrollment among college-age students was up slightly, but not enough to offset the exodus of adult learners. The number of students age 18 to 24 increased 0.4% this spring, while enrollment among students older than 24 declined 4%. At public universities that offer four-year degrees, the number of students increased 18 to 24, 1.4%. Nonprofit private institutions that offer four-year degrees saw a 0.6% increase in college-age students. For-profit institutions were hit hardest by the booming economy. Both college-age and adult students were down nearly 7% at for-profit schools that offer four-year degrees. You know what I'd like to see over the next 3 or 4 years? I'd like to see the amount of loans that kids are taking out for college and what the curriculum is that they're picking up. I'd love to see that information. And that information will be coming out. But I'd like to see, like, from right now, take from right now to 4 years from now. Take a four-year span and see what that is. I'd love to see whether there has been a change. You see, with adults, there's a change. The adult students. Sorry, I can get the job now. Bye. I'm not going to be paying that kind of that amount of money. So you see that economics has hit there. Has economics hit with younger students when it comes to what their choice is and the amount of loans that they are willing to take out? Or do they still believe, look, I really don't have to pay back the loan? Does that mindset still exist out there with the younger students where it doesn't with the adult students? Just the questions that I would ask. And more stories out there. We had brought this to you yesterday. It's a story that's actually a week old, but it was the Connecticut track and field competition. Here it is. Here's a headline from the Daily Mail. Students and parents demand unfair rule change after two transgender team sprinters come in first and second in the girls' state championship. Transgender teen Terry Miller set new records at the CIAC State Open Track and Field Competition, finishing in first place for the 100 and 200-meter dashes. A Connecticut high school sophomore dominated in last week's track and field competition, but the transgender teen's big win has some people outraged and wondering if it's fair that he was allowed to compete. Terry Miller, who was born a male but identifies as a female, came in first place twice during the June 4th state open track and field competition. During the 100-meter dash, Miller smoked the competition, finishing the race in just 11.72 seconds. Fellow transgender Andrea Yearwood also dominated at the competition, finishing in second place in the 100-meter dash to the other biological male. Last year, Yearwood came in first in both the 100 and 200-meter dashes in the state championship. Some of the girls' competitors were angry that they were allowed to compete on the women's team. I think it's unfair to the girls who really work hard to do well and qualify for the open, said one sophomore. Another teen's mother told the Connecticut Post that there's no transgender competition when it comes to things like math and science and course, but with sports, it's different. Sports are set up for fairness. Biologically, male and female are different, adding the great majority is being sacrificed for the minority. According to the Hartford Courant, this mother has gotten about 60 people to sign a petition calling for the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference to change its rule that athletes are allowed to compete in the gender-specific sport of which they identify. A second petition started by a father of two is also calling for the rule to be changed. As of Monday, it had more than 80 supporters. So there you go. As we've said all along, no, the goal should be to get rid of all biological women in sports. Right? That should be the goal. Let's marginalize biological women in sports. Where are the feminists? Where's the fury from the feminists? Nothing. As we've always said, if a male can be a female at any time, feminism is dead. There is no feminism if anybody, there is no women's rights if anybody can be a female. With the transracial rights movement also started, if anybody can be black, then the civil rights movement is also dead. Will the liberal civil rights activist be as quiet as the feminists have been so far? That will be interesting to see. If you want to get in, we do have a line open, 866-90-RED-EYE.
Are your tires prepared to spring into the warmer months ahead? Tire failures are more common in the summer for many reasons, but it often comes down to one thing: air pressure. Improperly inflated tires can result in reduced traction and less control. When a tire operates at an improper inflation level, it will flex each time it rotates. Over time, this causes the wire package inside a tire's sidewalls to flex beyond its intended range and frequency. While a tire may look normal, it's very possible that it will fail as soon as the asphalt beneath it gets hot. Spring is the perfect time to inspect your tires for this kind of damage or other indications that they may have been running on low air pressure.
This maintenance tip is a service of TA Truck Service Road Squad. If you break down, we show up. Call 800-924-SHOP.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and he has the morning off. I'm Gary McNamara. Welcome and good morning. Let us go to Craig in Reno. Been talking about the Inspector General's report and really everything that's happened over the last couple of years. Craig, welcome in Reno. You're on Red Eye Radio. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing this evening?
Very good.
So my premise on this whole deal is that the redactions and everything else is for national security. The point of the matter is that the redactions of means and methods are really not for national security. It's really their means and methods of which they're trying to hide stuff from the American people.
And everybody knows it, because every time they've cried wolf from the beginning, remember when the Republicans wanted to release the memo and they went crazy? The Republicans don't care about national security. They're putting lives at risk. All of that was a lie, and that came from the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Democrats, and it was all a lie. Nothing. No national secrets were released, and that has been the cry coming from the FBI and the Department of Justice from the very, very beginning. The whole point is, who releases it? The only one who could authorize that to release it all would be the president. And if the president says you need to release this information, then he's getting involved in the investigation, because the Democrats will scream and yell that, hey, you're only releasing part of the information. You're not releasing it all. And so that's a problem that you face there. But I think there will come a time when the president might have to do that. I don't know when that time would be. But, you know, he has talked about it, but the fact is, the thing that should bother the Americans the most, and I think it bothers some of us. I don't think it bothers us as much as it should a lot of us, not talking to you, but a lot of Americans, is the fact that these bureaucrats believe they're unaccountable to the people, to we the people, and that's just dead wrong.
undeniably irrefutable. Red Eye Radio.
And he is Eric Hurley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Welcome and good morning. Just want to cover a few other topics because I know on tomorrow's show, all depending on what comes out of the Inspector General's report, tomorrow may dominate tomorrow's show with that. So a couple of other stories. Forbes had this, but it comes from the Fraser Institute of Canada. This says, more people, record number of people, believe that we should have some type of national health care system in this country. Canada's single-payer system forced over 1 million patients to wait for necessary medical treatments last year. It's an all-time record. Those long wait times were more than a nuisance. They cost patients $1.9 billion in lost wages, a new report by the Fraser Institute think tank released. Lengthy treatment delays now are the norm in Canada and other single-payer nations with which ration care to keep costs down. Yet more and more Democratic leaders are pushing for a single-payer system, and more voters are clamoring for one. Indeed, 3 in 4 Americans now support a national health plan. The summary from the Fraser Institute, one measure of the privately borne cost of wait times in Canada is the value of time that is being lost while waiting for treatment. Valuing only hours lost during the average week, the estimated cost of waiting for care in Canada for patients who were waiting for care, $1.9 billion. This works out to an average of $1,800 for each of the estimated 1 million Canadians waiting for treatment in 2017. So this is a conservative estimate that places no intrinsic value on the time individuals spend waiting in a reduced capacity outside the work week, valuing all hours of the week, including evenings and weekends, but excluding 8 hours of sleep per night, would increase the estimated cost of waiting to $5.8 billion. This estimates only only counts the costs that are borne by the individual waiting for the treatment. The costs of care provided by family members, the time spent caring for the individual waiting for treatment, and their lost productivity due to difficult or mental anguish are not valued in that estimate. Moreover, non-monetary medical costs such as the increased risk of mortality or adverse events that result directly from long delays for treatment are not included in that estimate. So that was just recently released by the Fraser Institute, but a record now, 1 million, and this is for 2017 when they look back, okay? It was done just recently. The report came out, but it was for the latest year that they had a complete for, which was 2017. Over 1 million patients now wait for necessary medical treatments in Canada. As we've said, you can't have it both ways. Nothing is free. And if you believe you can get discount medical care, well, you suffer in the fact that you have to wait for it. And as we have stated, the wait times that we have brought to your attention in the past in Canada, if applied to the people in the United States tomorrow, would probably set a revolution going. Because it would be so unacceptable to the people of the United States to wait as long as you have to wait in Canada. Months. What was it, neurosurgery? I think it was like 50 weeks. When people want medical care, they want medical care now. And it's funny how it doesn't seem to... Look, we understand this because we've talked about this before. Since a majority of people are not actively getting major health care, the majority of people just want the pretend security of we're covered. Just cover it. Give us a pretend security that we're covered and we feel happy. And that's because the vast majority of Americans or any society are not in the process of dealing with major medical care or major medical problems at one time. It's only a minority. They're very, very small. The people that at any one time are in the medical care system with major problems as compared to the whole. But when you see Canada, a country of what, 35 million, that 1 million patients are waiting for necessary medical treatment last year, you probably can make the good calculated guess it's the majority of people who need major medical treatments are waiting for major medical treatment. And so, just like other topics that we have talked about, the more information we get, the more information that we as a society ignore. It really does come down to, well, if somebody else will pay it for me, give me the perception of security. The perception of security is better than actually having security. Now, I'll scream and yell when I have to wait, but at that point, it's too late when you're in a system like that that's run by the government, because as we know, once the government gets its hands on an entire system or an entire industry, they're not going to let go. And so things only get worse, as we have seen it in Canada. And they've, by the way, they've spent billions of dollars trying to solve the problem of wait times. And they haven't been successful in doing it. But we as Americans, and it's funny because we complain about what's part of the complaining that we've done, you know, today? When we look at everything with the Inspector General's report, bureaucrats not accountable to the people. Well, if they're not accountable to the people when it comes to major criminal investigations, if they're not accountable to the people when it comes to presidential elections and what they might have done to change what happened in a presidential election, if they don't feel that they need to be accountable to people, and that's happening in the United States, what in the heck makes you believe that the bureaucrat will care about you as an individual when you need medical care? We still live with the... We still have the delusion that we love the illusion that a big government will somehow take care of us. Either that, or we just believe that somebody else will pay the freight for what I need. And hopefully that will happen. I'd rather take the risk that somebody else will pay for it than me take full responsibility of something that may be quite expensive, which means I've got to give up something in my life in order to pay for my own medical care. Because there's no way that if you pay attention to healthcare systems around the world, if you really look at it and you're really concerned about the care that you wish to get when you get a major disease or get in a major accident and you want the best health care, if you're thinking about the best, it is impossible to look at a system like the national health care system in Great Britain or the single payer health care system in Canada, and you are just delusional if you think that's where you're going to get the best health care. Why? We don't need to go past the waiting times. Well, I may have to wait. Now, waiting is everything when it comes to major things with your health care. Trying to think, what was the disease the one girl had that she needed to be in the room and they only had the limited rooms and she ended up dying waiting on the waiting list? And I forgot what that was for. I forgot what, and she was a young girl too. I've always said, when you look at the, you have to look at the worst that you can possibly get in one system. And when we had this great debate on with Obamacare, the great debate was, well, I can go bankrupt with my medical care. So, yep, you can go bankrupt. You can, I can lose everything in order to live. What's the other option? Well, they'll guarantee me health care, but I can die on a waiting list. Well, I'd rather have that. The bankruptcy bothers me more than the death. I'll never forget the guy that we had called one time, and we convinced him. Eric and I convinced this gentleman that the private sector provides better health care. And if you bring in the proper competition, he agreed that it probably would be the same, maybe a little bit more expensive, and maybe even less, but the actual health care and the timeliness of the health care would be better. And he still said, no, I would be for a single-payer system. We said, how? He said, because nobody should make a profit in the medical care system, that the profit motive is evil. Yeah, but you're getting better health care. You're surviving because of it. It doesn't matter. It's not right to make a profit. And at that point, we just threw up our hands and said, okay, give up. What do you do in that case? What do you do? Well, the profit motive is evil. But it gives you, what's more moral? A system that ensures that you'll survive and can have a productive and healthy life? Or a system that doesn't provide it, that says they care, but when it comes to the actual caring, which would be getting the timely medical care that you need, they can't give it to you. But as long as their intent is right, which is they claim they care, that's more moral of a system from those in a profit-seeking system that provides health care, because they're more concerned, you believe, about the profit and not your health care. How do you win? 866-90-RED-EYE.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. I'm Gary McNamara, along with Eric Harley, who has a morning off. Let's go to Russ in Detroit. Russ, welcome. We had just mentioned that study that had come out in Canada about how many people are actually in waiting lines to get necessary surgery, which is 1 million right now, which would be unacceptable here in the United States. But welcome to the show.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
Good.
I've heard this debate for years now. And I live in a border state with Canada, and I know plenty of people that come over here to get their shoulder surgery, hip replacements done because of the wait time. But when I explain to my liberal friends, if you would, the problems with that, I said, if you want to see national health care, and I haven't heard any talking heads or radio personalities compare this, but our VA system's a mess.
Well, that's been made many.
You spread that out.
Yeah, that's been made many. That comparison has been made many, many times.
Well, that's what we're looking at.
Yeah.
If we can't straighten out the small amount of veterans that are getting in need of care, how are you going to do 350 million people that way?
There was actually a news story the other day about President Trump signing a bill that would give access to more private facilities to veterans. So, I mean, just in the last week, that made the news. And Eric and I have said this a long, long time ago. This is years ago. We said that in the VA system, they should actually look at, instead of having an entire infrastructure of hospitals, would it be cheaper just to give out a VA card, where the majority of your expenses would be taken care of in the private sector, and you would have the private sector, in essence, bid for the, you know, the millions that are available, you know, to be used in the VA system, whether the card and not having an entire infrastructure of VA hospitals and a VA department on the federal level, you know, what would the cost be and what would the cost analysis be? And it seems like the government is slowly heading in that direction, which we believe would probably be a good thing. Because if you look at the infrastructure, the government's setting it up in a monopoly like that with all the VA hospitals that exist. And you say, well, instead of doing that, we're going to give you a card. And this card guarantees you the treatment, and you set up, you know, the government sets up a bidding process to healthcare facilities all over the country. How much would you save? And for years we've been asking, you know, what would a study and what would the research say would happen in that? Well, apparently they've been doing it. I haven't seen the studies, but last week I noticed when the president came out to sign a bill that would make it easier, not for all, but for many veterans to get access to private services out there. I thought, well, okay, somebody at least in the federal government is thinking that way, which to me would be good.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. He's Eric Harley, and he's got the morning off. I'm Gary McNamara. And before we get to the news here, just reading here this story from the Daily Caller about Berkeley declares a climate emergency and calls for population control. Now, this is the city council? The Berkeley City Council, fix the pothole, will you? The Berkeley City Council unanimously voted to mobilize other California governments to initiate a just local, state, national, and global climate emergency mobilization to restore a safe climate. In order to accomplish this, it would require an effort to preserve and restore half Earth's biodiversity in interconnected wildlife corridors and to humanely stabilize population. Boy, did they get into the discussion of how you would humanely stabilize the population? How would you humanely stabilize the population? Any suggestions there from the left? I remember Eric and I a few years back. There was some guy in the far left talking about that fact that we had to somehow get rid of 6 billion people and get down to a billion maximum on the planet. And he said all towns and cities should be at least 100 miles. I'm not sure if it was 100 miles. There was a certain distance, like 100 miles or more. And the biggest population of any town can only be 25,000. And the guy's going through this whole essay on this. And Eric and I are reading this saying, how do you do it? Hello, I'm going to raise my hand here. How do you eliminate 6 billion people to get to this point? And, of course, they really never discussed that portion of it. But here where they talk about humanely stabilizing the population. You start having to start think of how do you do that? Forced abortions? Mandatory birth control for everyone? How do you solve it? It's the law. If you don't use birth control, you go to jail. No families are allowed. In order to stop procreation, only gay marriage will be allowed. Heterosexual marriage will be outlawed. I'm just trying to think of ways that you can come up with humanely. Stabilize the population. Then again, we must remember, humanely from the far left might not be the definition of humanely that you and I are thinking. But this is what the Berkeley City Council is discussing. Wow. I just had to bring that up. So, all right, in the news today, actually, the stage is being set later on today for, well, I'm reading here, this is from Fox News, bombshell Inspector General report. Don't know whether it's going to be bombshell or not. I can't tell you whether it will or not. I do know the limitations of the Inspector General. I'm not saying that there aren't going to be findings that make people go, whoa. Jeff Sessions said, if there's fireable offenses, we'll fire people, depending on what's in this report. I don't know. I just know the limitations of the Inspector General versus, for example, Mueller or the House or Senate Intelligence Committee or the Judiciary Committees. They have subpoena power for people that they can interview people that aren't actually working in the government. The Inspector General can only interview people. He can only force people, I guess, who actually work there to testify. If you don't work there anymore, you can't be made to testify before the Inspector General, who was Michael Horowitz. So we'll see where it goes from there. Of course, under the microscope would be Comey. Then Attorney General Loretta Lynch. Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. Yeah, will they all be under the microscope on this? They probably have been for the last year. It is at least a 500-page report is what I'm being told. Some comments on it. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goulet predicted Wednesday, I think it's going to put a lot of missing pieces in that giant puzzle together. And the first sentence of the Fox News article, a slew of FBI and Department of Justice officials could face a reckoning. Okay, I said reckoning. It's reckoning. When Justice Department, I don't know why I just said reckoning, just sounded cooler. It will face a reckoning when Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz releases his long-awaited report detailing the review of the Hillary Clinton investigation during the 2016 presidential race. As we have talked about during the show, we all know, and anybody knows, that anybody else who did what she did would have been charged. I don't know whether they would have been convicted. I know they would have been charged. If anybody else in government took and put a private server in their home, the classified information was going to go through. Any one of them any one of them would have been charged with a crime. We all know that. We know specifically what the crime is. The intent, when he said there was no intent, the intent was putting the server in your home. That's the intent. You put it in your home, why? You put it in your home to avoid the Freedom of Information Act. That's why you do that. And so you put it in so you can bypass the system of accountability. There's no other reason to do it. That's the intent. Well, she didn't state the intent. You don't need to state the intent. And the other crime would be knowing that by putting the server in, top secret classified material would be going outside the system through a private server, and that's the part of the espionage law that was broken. So there's two of trying to avoid the Freedom of Information Act and the espionage law, which is letting the top secrets out in unsecured areas. Easy. We can identify what the crime is. After 2 years now of the Trump investigation with the FBI and Mueller, nobody can still identify what the possible crime would be. Here we can identify precisely what the crimes were. Anybody else would have been charged in the government. You know it. I know it. Anybody in the military would have been charged. You know it. I know it. Democrats used to defend her until after the election, and then Democrats didn't really defend her anymore. We used to get Democrats calling up and defending Hillary. She did nothing wrong. You can put a server in. How do you know she didn't put the server? Well, we all know nobody's debating those talking points. Even then, they didn't have any solid talking points but they still attempted to defend her. You can't defend her. Nobody does now. Everybody knows what she did was a crime. And nobody is debating what she did. We all know she put the server in her home. I think the one thing that I would like to know, there's a bunch of different things, but the one thing, and this is just in the last 2 months, and we had talked about this earlier, is the fact that when Comey wrote his book, in his book, he said the reason that he took over and gave that press conference about whether they were going to go after Hillary or not was because there was so much damning classified information from a source, unverified, about the Attorney General Loretta Lynch, that if the opposition would have gotten it, it would have just destroyed the Justice Department's credibility. I wonder, because that came out in early April. It was April 12th. We went back in the show and looked at that and said, you know, he put that in his book. The Inspector General wasn't done. He said over 2 months to look at that. Did he look at it? Had he already looked at that? Did he know about that? And what's that all about? Because the couple of questions on that is, Comey says they were unverified. Well, were they when he wrote the book? Or were they just unverified when he was still FBI director? Were they verified afterwards? And if they were unverified, you've got to have hundreds upon hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe millions of unverified accusations that you can pick up from intelligence sources that probably hit anybody who was in government at any time. If they're unverified, why would you be scared of them? If you didn't believe that they were credible, how could the opposition use it against you? You could look at Obama and say there was a ton of things against Obama that were unverifiable accusations against him. Does that mean that he couldn't do his job as president because of unverified accusations? Does that mean because there's unverified accusations against President Trump, he can't do his job? If they're unverified, it means there's no credibility. We know the unverified accusations against Trump. Everybody knows what they are, and they're quite salacious. He's still president. What was it about Loretta Lynch? What were these accusations against her that were so damning that even unverifiable, Comey said he had to announce it? Nobody from the Justice Department could. Sally Yates couldn't. Because naturally, if she recused herself, next thing would go to Sally Yates. Right? Why couldn't she do it? Why couldn't anybody from the Justice Department make the decision? Why did you? What were you so worried about with those accusations against the Justice Department, even unverified, that scared the daylights out of you or made you so concerned that you had to take it over? I don't know if that'll be answered in the Inspector General's report. That's something that I want answered. And eventually we'll probably come to the truth of that one. So it'll be coming out a little bit later on today, and I'm sure we'll have a ton of coverage on it. It will be interesting to see what is in it. It is a 500-page document, but I'm sure with the number of people out there in the media, it will quickly be disseminated. I'm not sure exactly what time it comes out, what time it's supposed to come out. Remember, in the draft version of the report, Comey was called insubordinate. Calling him out for making the public statement. Horowitz investigation has looked at whether it was improper for Comey to make a public announcement about not recommending prosecution over the Clinton email argument. He memorably faulted Clinton and her associates for being extremely careless with classified information. A draft version of the report called Comey insubordinate, calling him out for making that statement, as well as notifying Congress the probe was being reopened days before the election, according to ABC News. So if they are looking into that, my question would be, what was the unverifiable thing that they had? What was it? What scared Comey that much? Or is Comey lying about it? Was there nothing, no unverifiable things against Loretta Lynch? Was that a lie? But that should be looked into by the inspector general, correct? Because that goes to the core of what happened during the Hillary email investigation. It goes right to the core of it. One would think that the inspector general would look into it, and so it would be very interesting to see whether, because if Comey's insubordinate and shouldn't have done those things, then is he lying? All questions. 866-90-RED-EYE.
The Agriculture Department's Undersecretary for Trade says he doesn't know what the next steps will be for economic and trade discussions with Japan.
I do know that the U.S., and I think, frankly, Japan as well, want very much to get into some trade discussions.
Ted McKinney is in Japan this week leading a U.S. trade mission, a group representing U.S. food and ag businesses and others, and he told reporters it seems the U.S. prefers one-on-one negotiations. Japan would prefer the U.S. rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meanwhile, there is talk of tariffs and other possible trade disruptions, but as to that affecting the trade mission folks?
The group is remarkably upbeat. They are realistic. They know that there are tariffs. There might be more coming, but they recognize the importance of this market, and it was one of, we'll roll with whatever we've got.
McKinney said trade mission participants are telling him it's worth going on the mission to build new sales and trade opportunities for the future. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
The USDA report is sponsored by Cenex Roadmaster XL Premium Highway Diesel Fuel and Shell Rotella.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. I'm Gary McNamara. Eric has the morning off. In other news, approval for Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election has dropped to an all-time low among registered voters. According to a poll released on Wednesday, 36% of voters now view Mueller in an unfavorable light, up from 23% from 11 months ago when polling began, according to the Politico Morning Consult poll. Broken down by party, 53% of Republicans say they view the special counsel negatively, while the number of Democrats who view Mueller unfavorably rose to 24%. President Trump and his political allies, this is from the Free Beacon, have upped the criticism directed at the special counsel's probe, saying it's gone on too long and reached beyond its intended scope. In the midst of continuing critiques, the latest poll shows a 26-point increase in unfavorable views among Republicans since polling began 11 months ago. There was also an article in the Liberal magazine, the Liberal website, The Nation, that said, look, there's nothing there that leads to collusion. Talking about Mueller, I was shocked to see that. I had it somewhere here in my papers. Oh, can I find it? There it is right here. Aaron Mattei, the Mueller, and this is in The Nation, and I noticed this because The Nation is one of the nation's leading liberal publications. The Mueller indictments still don't add up to collusion. A year of investigations has led to several guilty pleas, but none of those go to the core of the special counsel's mandate. In just over 1 year, special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of the Trump campaign in Russia has generated 5 guilty pleas, 20 indictments, and more than 100 charges. None of these have anything to do with Mueller's chief focus, the Russian government allegedly meddling in the 2016 election, and the Trump campaign's suspected involvement. Just important to bring that up because that's from The Nation, one of the leading liberal publications in America. 866-90-RED-EYE. It's time for your national forecast brought to you by Omnitrax.
Strong high pressure is keeping conditions excessively hot across the desert southwest as that hurricane in the Pacific, Bud, continues to make its way towards the Baja Peninsula. Monsoon threats will increase for the region. Our severe weather threat today has shifted to mainly across North Dakota. We'll see spotty showers in the south along I-10 from eastern Texas over to Jacksonville today. A few select cities forecast and today's high temperature. This will be the last day for showers before a few clear days ahead in Seattle. High today 67. Sunny at 79 in Los Angeles. Mostly sunny, 108 in Phoenix. Rain chances start Friday with daytime highs down into the 90s by the weekend. Dallas 96 today, but we'll see temperatures above 90 for at least through Monday. New York City sunny and 83. Atlanta 50-50 chance of rain, high 90. Your national forecast from Red Eye Radio. I'm meteorologist John Trout.
Thanks so much, John. 866-90-RED-EYE.
Do-gooder tough guys, Gary McNamara and Eric Harley, Red Eye Radio.
And I'm Gary McNamara. Eric has the morning off. You know, initially I didn't have an audio cut of the day. I was like, nothing really. I was like, okay, they're rehashing everything. And then I found this little bit of audio and I said, okay, I've got an audio cut of the day. I just wanted to play it just for the heck of it because it was on CNN on Wednesday night and it was Seymour Hersh, who broke the story on My Lai in Vietnam, the My Lai massacre, also reported on Abu Ghraib and has worked for The New Yorker for a long time, sort of walks to his own beat kind of thing, but got into about, Trump calling, the president calling the media the biggest enemy and all that, and it got to be quite interesting, and, he talked about the fact that, look, you know, you people cover them all the time. You're covering them all the time. You know, your ratings are going up, but his ratings are going up. And so it works for him. But they got into other discussions here, and I just want to play a little bit of it because it was interesting to hear this back and forth going on CNN last night. Here we go.
On the other hand, he's going up in ratings. And so I don't see the Democratic Party doing anything but basically running sort of as Hillary did, running against them for the last 2 months of the campaign. And I'm not sure that if I'm not in the major city in America, I'm not sure. This guy is different. And I think people are tired of politicians. And he appeals for a lot of reasons that maybe we don't all understand. I certainly don't understand him. He's got, 48%, 47% of the people. He appeals to them. There's something about him. This is a guy that took down 13 Republicans with about a history of, more than 200 years of political life.
So, 200 years of Seymour, I get experience. What you're saying. But to me, I'm just listening, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you're conflating the Democratic Party with the news media. It's not the news media's job to say, well, we're going to help him go up in the polls by talking about him. It's our job to analyze his policies and his behavior and what he says and what he does. That's our job.
With all due respect, and I'm not talking about you or your show.
I'm talking about the news in general. But
I think the public, we have a public right now. There was a time when the media was trusted. We go back to the old days of networks, and those days are long gone. When I worked at the New York Times, I always felt I was working for a newspaper. No matter what you said, where you were, it was trusted. We now have a situation where a lot of people tune in to what they like.
Right.
And don't listen to what they don't like.
Right.
It's good for cable television on both sides, both for Fox News and CNN, MSNBC. You guys, you've got great ratings. You're making money. I think the New York Times every quarter says it's picked up another 200,000 subscriptions because they're very critical of Trump. And so you have this notion, if you don't like Trump, you're going to go here. If you like Trump, you're going to go somewhere else. And where's the middle ground? Where is the media that is accepted? Where?
There you go. I just thought I would play a part of that because I found it interesting. And as we've always said, you know, the whole media landscape has changed, though. The New York Times isn't as powerful as it used to be. The networks aren't as powerful powerful as they used to be. For cable television, and I see the ratings all the time, you know, even in the times of great, great stories, 4 or 5 million people are watching, and that's great, and you make a ton of money when you have that kind of viewership, but there's 330 million people in the country. So the fact is, so many people get their news from the internet. It has changed everything. And are there some people that just watch? I actually know an old friend of mine who is I call a amateur liberal, because really doesn't pay much attention to politics. But when I saw her about a year ago, she said, "I really don't watch any news. I only go home after a 12-hour day and watch Rachel Maddow." Like, oh my, really? So that's all you watch? She goes, "That's the only thing I hear in the media every day is Rachel Maddow." And I said, "Well, you've got to get out." But the other thing is, and I think Hirsch fails to understand this, because I meet people every day that know both sides of the issue, which means they may go to Fox News because they know what they're going to get. But then they also go to, you know, they may not spend as much time, but also they'll go, "All right, what's going on in CNN over here? Let me just go by. They got this guy on. Okay, I'll watch it." And they may get disgusted with it, but they watch it, but they get the message. People that I know, people that I chat with, even people that I know, because I do believe that there are more people practicing tribalism and political idolatry on both sides of the issue. On both sides, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. But even those that practice the tribalism that exists today, when you actually talk to them, they know what's going on. Sometimes, and we talked about this yesterday, if you talk about the tribalism or the political idolatry of President Trump, there are some people, you know, because that came out yesterday. What did Corker or somebody say, that the Republican Party has become cultish to supporting Trump? Well, when we broke it down about a year ago, maybe 8 months ago, because we were talking about the different factions, we came up with really 8 different factions that we could see from over the last couple of years that people supported Trump. And so when any politician, whether it's on the Republican side or the Democrat side, you're going to have a certain number of people that practice political idolatry, that practice tribalism. My guy or nothing. My guy is always right. And then you'll have the other people, "No, he's always wrong." You're always going to have it. Look, there's 320 million or 330 million people in this country. And then you have most of the people that I meet that, even if they want to, because they understand the opposition is just pounding Trump all of the time. And so a lot of those people will say, "I support Trump, I support Trump, I support Trump." And then you get down with it when they know that you're not going to jump on them or demonize them, and you start talking, they go, "Well, yeah, you know, I don't like this about him. I like this, but those guys are worse, and so I've got to defend him." And so that I understand. I understand the outward appearance that people will have, especially on social media. And then when you sit and actually talk to them about it, their feelings are really deeper, and their analysis, I think, for the most part, at least from a lot of people that I know that I meet and deal with, even on social media, where you figure, go, "Oh, this guy's really a Bubba." And then you actually, with non-threatening, ask them a question, and you realize, "Oh, okay, that's just the first outward appearance. They're actually willing to discuss the actual issue out there." So I also think that what you get in a conversation like that from Seymour Hirsch and Don Lemon is they still are all part of the Beltway, even though I think Hirsch does understand and recognize that, look, there's a ton of people out there that you don't deal with every day. There's middle America out there. There are people that aren't in this bubble of the Washington or New York Beltway or the Hollywood elite. They're outside of it. They think different. And so, yeah, we've got to analyze them. And part of the analyzation is everybody's only looking at one media and that's all, and nobody looks at the other side. Yeah, they do. If you listen to the show and our callers, You know they do. They know what's going on the other side. They have to. In order to really defend your argument, you have to know what the other side, what their argument is. But Hirsch did make some great points. He goes, you look at the Democrats, you look at the media. They're just pounding. Nobody on the other side's coming up with any solutions on the Democrat side. It's about the strategy is pound on Trump 24/7. He's a fascist. He's evil. He's a misogynist. He's racist. He's all this. We've said this many times, if you've listened to this show. There are some disagreements that we have with him. We analyzed what we thought was good, what was hopeful in the North Korean summit, and the things that we wouldn't have said that we thought can be used against him later on, that it's a huge risk that he is taking. But as I had a, you know, I mentioned yesterday was a great day for a talk show host because there were, you know, we were getting emails from both sides. Why do you hate Trump or why do you always defend him no matter what? And we're like, well, then you don't really listen to the show because it's not about Trump. I'm not anti-Trump or pro-Trump. I voted for Trump, but I voted for Trump because he is the person that I believe can do the best job of the people that I had a choice in picking. And it was that simple. We don't practice political idolatry. I don't love him. I don't hate him. I would ask him the one question I would ask him. I was thinking about this yesterday. The one question I would ask Trump that would get personal with him, if I had a chance, what's in your golf bag? I really want to know a guy like that he's turning 72, right? I really want to know what kind of golf clubs he uses because he apparently plays really good, which means I don't think with the body, his size, I'm not insulting him, but he's just a bigger guy. And at that age, he probably doesn't have a great turn. So I'm wondering what kind of clubs he uses to get that ball to the trajectory and the length that I hear that he actually hits a golf ball. So there you have it. That'd be the one question I'd have to ask him. And it'd probably be a decent conversation. But other than that, I don't dislike, I don't hate or love anybody. I don't know them. I'm not personally related to them. And as an adult, even if I wasn't a talk show host, I'd be analyzing, what are they doing? What are they doing? What are they doing? What are they doing? So for everything that I've liked that Trump is doing, which is the majority, I gave him a B for his first year. I've never given any president a B. He exceeded my expectations. Doesn't mean I won't criticize him on something tomorrow. But the fact is, it's analyzing. Here's what I believe. Here's what I like. Here's what I think works. Oh, he agrees with me there. He agrees with me there. He agrees with me there. Oh, he disagrees with me there. Okay, why does he disagree with me? Okay, that's a bad argument. Okay, I agree with him there. Oh, that's a really good argument that he made there. That's how we look at it. Very, very unemotional. And so, you know, when we get that all the time, well, you guys are too pro-Trump. Actually, we're not pro or anti. We're analyzing. We have our conservative libertarian beliefs. We defend them. Boom. And I think most people, even if their outer shell is to defend Trump, you're always going to find Bubba's out there that I don't care about what he stands. I don't care about what we had those calls during the campaign. I don't care what he stands for. Just destroy everything. And then there are people that may have that outer shell stating, I just believe him no matter what. And then you start go a little deeper and you find, okay, I don't like this about him, but I like this. But he's better than her. And of course I had a vote. So I've got to show that support because there's so many people that are pounding against him. Okay, that I can understand. No problem at all. But I thought it was an interesting conversation with Seymour Hirsch. But no, I don't believe that everybody just sticks to one media and that's it. But I do believe that the media is fragmented where you go to a particular media because you do know what you're getting. That I do agree with. It has changed that way. And I think it's good that we don't have three media outlets like we used to have, you know, on the national level on TV that are all trusted and nobody is questioning what they do. I like the questioning today. I like having the number of media outlets that we have today. And I like everybody questioning. I like people complaining. I like people getting angry about what they see in the media and analyzing what they see in the media every day and having a healthy distrust of what they see in the media, what they may hear on a radio show, whether it's ours or whatever. I want that healthy distrust. I want people to walk into it. I think Americans should walk in going, I'm not going to believe you just because I liked what you said yesterday. So there you go. All right, 866-90-RED-EYE.
The dates and location for the 36th annual Shell Rotella Super Rigs contest are set. Dave Waterman from Shell has the details.
We are going to be at White's Travel Center in Raphine, Virginia. It's a little bit outside of Lexington, Virginia, right off of I-81 and I-64. It was designed way back when as a way for Shell Rotella to give back to the trucking community, appreciation for all they did and all the support of our brand. It's an event that really encourages truckers to get together, whether they're going to show a show caliber truck or just their daily driver that might have some scratches and dings in it. It's open to all of them. And in fact, we encourage, as you know, the working truck. Judging, of course, is going to take place Thursday through Saturday. We're going to have a light contest taking place on Thursday, and then we'll do a truck parade down to Old Town Lexington. There'll also be health checks available for truckers on site. We're going to do the scavenger hunt again so folks can walk away with prizes. Just on the Shell Rotella Super Rigs part of it, it's up to $25,000 in both cash and prizes.
They want to learn more. Where do they go?
Well, they can go to Rotella.com. They can also go to whitestravelcenter.com.
This Super Rigs update is a service of Shell Rotella.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. I'm Gary McNamara, Eric with the morning off. I tell you, the coolest news that I saw all day yesterday was the CNBC story about the Permian Basin oil producing in Texas and New Mexico that by 2023 will become the third biggest oil producing region in the world. That just the Permian Basin, that's Texas, West Texas, and New Mexico, will produce more oil. There'll only be two countries ahead, and that will be Russia and Saudi Arabia, of just the Permian Basin, not the United States as a whole. Just the Permian Basin. That is unbelievable. We salute American technology.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.